This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. In the new film, Roger and Me, an outside visitor tries to encourage the unemployed of Flint, Michigan to cheer up and remember that joblessness is an opportunity. Though the simple advice is clearly ironic in the movie, the filmmaker Michael Moore is in fact a living example of taking this course of action. Out of work as a magazine editor, he decided to make a movie about other out-of-work people in his hometown of Flint, a community nourished for 80 years by General Motors. For the past 20 years, GM has had a hard time persuading Americans to buy their cars and closed many plants in several states, laid off thousands of workers, and opened new factories in Mexico to help maintain their profits. Moore determined that the cause of the layoffs was Roger Smith, the chairman of General Motors, and the Roger in the title of the film. The me of the film, Moore, began a chimerical search to try to find Chairman Smith and invite him to visit the people of Flint. Roger and Me is an unexpected hit. The film, for which Moore raised $260,000, was bought by Warner Brothers for $3 million, a 1,150% return on the original investment. Moore depicts Smith as the arch-capitalist villain in this comedy. But should Roger and Michael ever have the confrontation Moore seeks, Smith might well admire the financial achievement of the filmmaker. Moore once said he hated documentaries, and I wondered why he then decided to make one.
You know, I'm the kind of guy who'd rather go see, you know, Die Hard and RoboCop and Terminator and, you know, Spinal Tap, I guess, you know. I think, unfortunately, most documentaries that we see on television have this sort of numbing effect. I mean, either they're already telling us something we know, or they're telling it to us in a way that doesn't really motivate us to act. You know, sort of Alistair Cook doing as the frozen tundra, you know, became desolate and the wolves crossed into the path, you know. I guess we all grew up with that, and I didn't want to do that kind of documentary. I wanted to make a kind of movie that people would come to see on a Friday night, you know, take a date, buy some goobers, and enjoy the show.
And your movie is very much, it's autobiographical, and it starts out with, home movies of yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Flint, Michigan, the hometown of General Motors, and my dad worked there for 33 years, as did all of my family, and so it's sort of a portrait of my hometown and what's happened to it in the 1980s.
I was curious in what sort of motivated you to put together this film?
Well, I was unemployed myself. I didn't have a job, and I was bored and depressed and started going to a movie every day. I mean, I'd go to those, you know, triplexes where I'd buy one ticket, you know, and skip between the three movies and just to relieve the boredom. And after a while, after seeing so many of these terrible movies, I thought, geez, maybe I should just make one, you know. These aren't very good, and I don't know anything about it, but what the heck, you know. So I called up some people who had made a film that I liked, and I asked them if they would come to Flint with me for a week and teach me what they could about filmmaking, and they did. And then for the next 2.5 years, I went on to make this film.
What was the most astonishing thing that you learned in the course of making a film?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. just how expensive the whole process is. I mean, it's got to be the most expensive art form around. If you want to write a book, I mean, really only need, you could do it with a pen and paper. You know, if you're making a painting, I guess you need a canvas and some paints. But for a movie, for every 10 minutes you want to shoot, you got to shell out $250 just for the film and its developing. So it's unfortunately an art form that's in the hands of those who have money, which is kind of sad, because if you want to express yourself creatively or put forth an idea and you don't happen to be of the moneyed class, you're kind of, you know, it's tough luck. So I had to sell my house, had a couple yard sales, sold all my possessions, started running bingo games, you know, did everything I could to raise the money to make this movie.
And were the bingo games announced as fundraisers for you?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So yeah, every Tuesday night, 200 people in Flint would show up to play bingo for this movie. I'm sure that's how Spielberg got his start. Don't laugh.
I'm not laughing. I mean, I'm just amused that that you pulled it off.
Yeah. Well, I am too, actually.
I mean, the total film ended up costing what, $250,000?
Yeah, about $250,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then how did you get it into such wide distribution? What was the...
Well, we entered some festivals, and Warner Brothers had representatives at these festivals, and they saw the film, and so they approached us, as did the other studios and independent distributors, and asked us, they wanted to distribute the film. So we started negotiating with all these companies, and Warner Brothers won out.
Your background is as a writer and an editor. you worked and you started your own paper, became the Michigan Voice,
right.
And worked for a short while for Mother Jones.
Right.
And now you're in the world of picking up phones and making deals with Hollywood. What kind of adjustments in your mind have you had to make?
I don't know. Not too many. I mean, I still feel like I'm the same guy. I mean, I still own my two pairs of jeans, you know. I mean, don't back up. They're clean. But I don't think much has changed. I don't know. I mean, I know it's kind of, I negotiated this deal. I didn't get an agent. I didn't get a lawyer. You know, I just did it on my own. But, you know, if you've ever bought a used car, it's pretty much the same thing.
Did you feel like you were dealing with the equivalent of used car salesman?
Well, now did I say that? No, they're very fine people, and they've done a great job, and they're going to get my movie into almost 1,000 theaters across the country. That's an incredible number of theaters.
And what kind of deals, what kind of stipulations did you attach to your distribution?
Well, in the film, there are a number of families who are evicted from their homes. And so one of the conditions was that Warner Brothers had to either purchase homes or pay the rent for these families who have been evicted, which they agreed to do. They had to distribute 20,000 tickets to the unemployed free of charge and a number of other things that I wanted them to do. And they were very good about it. I mean, they've given me whatever I've asked for.
My guest is Michael Moore. His new film, Roger and Me, depicts the closing of the General Motors plant in Moore's hometown of Flint, Michigan. And this film has had an unprecedented distribution deal with Warner Brothers for a documentary. You were born in Flint, Michigan.
Right,
and,
right.
And one of the aspects of the film is you talk about the heroes of Flint, Michigan are those who left. And I wonder why you feel that.
Well, I think you grew up in a factory town. And I think all of our parents wanted this for us, too. They wanted us to have a better life. And so you always think about getting out. And so I talk about the people who made it out of Flint, the woman who married Don Knotts, Casey Kasem, Bob Eubanks, host of the Newlywed Game, who later in the film makes his triumphant return home to do a version of the Newlywed Game with four auto worker couples in Flint. And tells a joke on camera that has, you know, caused a little bit of a controversy with the film.
It was a joke that could be taken as anti-Semitic, homophobic.
Anti-women, anti-gay. There's about at least four groups there that get wasted.
I'm curious. Did he know that he was being taped at the moment?
Oh, yeah,
did,
yeah,
did
yeah.
he know what the film was about?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we told him.
Uh-huh.
It was 10 in the morning, you know, he was sober. I mean, it's... I don't know. I can't explain it. That was our hometown boy, though.
I understand there's been some legal action to try and quash the film because of that segment in the.
Yeah. He hasn't filed anything yet, but the lawyers have been calling. They threatened New York Film Festival with an injunction to try and stop the film from being shown. They didn't do that. And now apparently he sent a letter to B'nai B'rith and they had some joint press conference together or whatever demanding that the scene be removed, and he's apologized to all Jews. Our position is that he has to send a letter to all Jews, not just to B'nai B'rith, so we'll see what comes of that.
Why did you include a scene like that in the movie, which
well,
is basically because, about GM? And
well, because when we were growing up and we were kids, we never knew about the sit-down strike in Flint, the 1937 sit-down strike that founded the UAW. And these important people who were really heroes were totally forgotten. Wasn't taught in school, never mentioned. But we knew who Bob Eubanks was. We knew that Bob Eubanks was from Flint. We knew he was the guy who had made it. And I just thought that there was something very strange and very ironic about that, and very wrong, that we'd know who Bob Eubanks was, but we didn't know who the sit-down strikers were. And so we went to see him. You know, he's the most famous guy from Flint. It's a movie about Flint. We figured, hey, you know, we had no idea what would happen.
But, I mean, why that particular scene? I mean, why would you include that joke that would be offensive to so many people in this film? I mean, he didn't live in Flint, and it wasn't part of the...
It has more to do with this whole thing of the American dream, which is essentially a dream. You know, this sort of, here's who's made it. And then he returns, and has he made it? Is he a hero? Is he somebody to look up to when you hear him, when you see him behave in this fashion? You know, he comes down off the pedestal pretty fast in about 15 words.
You're in the film a lot as the, I guess, the star of the film, the one who has the adventure going in search of Roger Smith. And you got very close to him a number of times, and then at a Christmas party, you were actually in a crowd with him. Were you pleased with the encounter? Did it come off the way you'd imagined it had been in your chase for him?
Well, no, because I wanted him to come to Flint. I mean, I'm very pleased with the scene in the movie. I think it's one of the most powerful scenes I've ever seen in any movie at Christmas when, as he's giving this speech and quoting Dickens, families in Flint are being thrown out of their homes. I watched that scene now, and I wonder sometimes why I didn't lunge at him. You know, it's the amount of restraint that I showed. I really don't understand it. I probably just was so scared at that moment because he had plainclothes security guards grabbing me by both elbows and trying to pull me away. So I thought for sure I was going to jail.
By that point in the making of your film, had you been sort of known? I mean, people had been told to watch out for this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They knew who I was by then and what we were up to. Definitely. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Somehow it strikes me that if you tried to approach the president or head of any corporation or the United States, I mean, in that way, anybody would be treated that way, even an employee of a corporation.
Yeah, except I tried phoning and then I wrote. I wasn't getting anywhere, so what do you do? I was out to get him to come to Flint.
What would you have shown him?
Well, I would have taken him to all the things you see in the film. Families being evicted from their homes, a woman who's selling bunnies as pets or meat. Take him to the Amway meeting. You know, drive him around in the van, have this running conversation with him about America in the 1990s. Sort of my dinner with Andre on wheels. That's how I envisioned it. You know, this hour and a half dialogue between Roger and me. I thought it would be an interesting movie.
But you've ended up dining alone. Part of your search for Roger Smith, the head of General Motors, takes you to the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club. And you've heard that he's going to be there for a lunch, and you want to try to beard him in the den there.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up in a conversation with a receptionist. And I wonder if you can describe how you found this and sort of set the scene.
Well, we've been traveling all over looking for him. We went to the Polo Club and the Hunt Club and the Waldorf in New York and everywhere trying to get this interview with him.
Did you have an intelligence staff that would sort of tip you off? Did you have anybody inside GM who'd call you and say, So you had your own deep throat.
Yeah. We were able to know a lot of times where he was or where he was going to be or, you know, what was what. And so we heard he was going to be at this charity luncheon at the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club. So we decided just to pay him a visit. I think that's pretty much is all you need to know.
I have a television crew down here with Michael Moore. He's supposed to meet Roger Smith at noon. I have no information.
How often does Mr. Smith come here for lunch or dinner?
The last time I saw him here was for Sportsman's Night.
Yeah, what's that?
It's a wild game dinner.
Yeah, you go out and shoot your own animal and...
Pardon me?
You go out and shoot your own the animals you shoot, you bring here and eat, or...
Well, some of the stuff is donated.
Yeah?
Yeah. The food's like a rattlesnake and... let me think of some real exotic foods. Alligator.
Eat this stuff here?
Roast beef.
Yeah, that sounds better.
I have a question about the receptionist in this scene who was telling you about the meal that the people were eating. Was she aware that she was being filmed at that time?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She seemed sort of so oblivious to the camera. And,
I know. I noticed a lot of people did. They never look at the camera. It's I don't know why. I think probably because we didn't look very threatening. I mean, we weren't the 60 Minutes crew. We weren't coming in like that. I mean, we were a bunch of people that had never operated equipment before, and we were trying to figure out what we were doing.
But you kind of... played off of that sort of yokel image, I imagine, too.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't something we were creating. It was really the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't know the difference between F-stop and F-troop. I mean, we are people who do not know how to set the timers on our VCRs. You know what I'm saying? They're still flashing 12, right? So, I think it worked in our favor.
She was one woman in the in the film that you depicted, there was also a former GM worker who'd started an Amway business and was doing people's colors. And the sense that I got in watching these, that they were being made fun of in the film. They were sort of being made sort of butts of jokes.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
And
that's not the way I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the film is a comedy, and it's a tragic comedy. It's a black comedy, and there are a lot of things that happen in the film that are very funny. It's what we're looking at a lot of times is the absurdity of some of this, and this isn't one of these David Byrne true stories things where some guy from New York goes down to Texas to laugh at the locals. I mean, we are those people. The Amway woman is a friend of mine. You know, I played her that scene before we even put it in the movie. She thought it was great. All she wanted to know is if she could hand out her Amway cards at the Flint premiere. And in fact, the biggest laugh in the whole movie comes when I get my colors done. I mean, they're they're laughing at me, I think, because I think I look like such a jerk. But I mean, it is a fine line. I understand what you're saying, and but I think these are people who are survivors. The Amway woman, the rabbit woman, people who have decided that they're not going to despair.
Well, you seem clearly to have a great deal of respect for people who work and want to work, and that comes across in the film. Yet the security guards and some of the PR people are people who need jobs and who are working too.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like you were giving them a bad time for doing what their work was.
But actually, we filmed them doing their job and doing it quite well.
Mm-hmm.
They did their job. They prevented me from seeing Roger Smith. You know, 2 points for them.
Do you see your film as a documentary or as a movie along the line of Spinal Tap?
It's both.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie that happens to be a documentary. We use real people and real events. Nothing is staged. Nothing is acted in this movie.
A number of people, including Pauline Kael and a writer and film comment, have pointed out that actually there are a number of sequences put out of order. For instance, Ronald Reagan shows up at a pizza parlor and is talking with the people of Flint, Michigan. And this event actually took place in 1980, 6 years before the action of the film.
No, the movie begins in 1979.
I suppose it begins at your birth in...
Yeah, if you want to put it that way, right.
But there's I came out of the theater with a very clear sense of a sequence of events. GM closes plant, 30,000 people laid off.
Yeah.
In fact, it was 10,000 people, I guess, in Flint, Michigan, and the rest were in...
No, 30,000 in Flint throughout the 80s.
Throughout the 80s.
Right.
But the sense of the film was that it was 1986 that this happened.
How did you get that sense? Because 1986 is never mentioned in the movie.
Because it's the demarcation where everything seems to fall apart in Flint, as you've depicted it, seems to take place when Roger Smith makes this announcement that plants are going to be closed.
But he makes a number of announcements in the film. There's a montage at the beginning of the film of five or six plant closings. You see Roger on there about three times making three different announcements. One of them is in 86, but you never see, 86 is never mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's one in 83 and there's one in 79.
Did you change sequences of events from chronological?
No.
How do you respond to Pauline Kael's criticism in the
author? Well, all she's doing is quoting from film comment.
Harlan Jacobson.
Yeah, and he was wrong. And he's just wrong.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's just wrong. What can I say? He had his facts wrong.
Are you saying that the words that he quoted of yours in here are not... are not yours?
No, I'm saying that the whole setup in that article, the things he's saying, the number of jobs, his facts are all wrong.
He has you saying, okay, so you can say that the chronology skips around a bit. That's why I don't use dates in the film. I just didn't want to deal with how to compact 8 years into 2.5 years that we were filming. So I don't say, well, this opened in 86, but that happened in 87. The point is, at the end of the Carter administration, factories started to close and jobs started to be eliminated. You'd be happy if I said in broadcast voice in 1979, if I had said something like that. And the Harlan Jacobson says, I think you could have established that with an insert or a crawl, that there wasn't a single blow. And you say, as far as I'm concerned, everything that took place in the 80s was a single blow. We're talking about an 80-year history of this company, and during the Reagan years, this was a single blow. if you're using the Gulf of Tonkin metaphor, where he says that you played fast and loose with the truth, then you're really hung up with this. He says, that's what happens when one manipulates sequence, and that's the core credibility of the documentary. And your response, all artless and every piece of journalism manipulates sequence and things. Now, are those your words?
Right, yeah.
All right. I felt as a viewer manipulated after I learned that the sequence of the film that is very clearly structured to make an entertaining movie, and it was powerful, and I felt very moved by it, but I also felt extremely misled.
Does it matter to you that Reverend Schuller came in response to the Chevy V6 engine plant closing as opposed to the Chevy V8 engine plant closing? I mean, is that, do you really want to know that? I mean, have you been hanging around PBS that long that you really want that sort of linear, real-time chronology?
I want to know when something is being shifted around for dramatic effect.
It's not. Well, it wasn't shifted around.
And
everything happened in the exact order that it happened in response to the plant closings. The layoffs began in 1979. Reagan came in 80. Schuller came in 83. Auto World opened in 84. The Hyatt and Water Street was in 86. And then the Hyatt was put up for sale in 87 after the last batch of plant closings. Water Street was put up for sale in 88, just this last year. You know, you just don't have your – we could get out the Flint phone book right now and call anybody in Flint, and they would tell you this. I wouldn't go by this article that has been factually, you know, proven wrong, even by the staff of Lincoln Center, which puts out the magazine. Call them. They'll tell you.
My guest has been Michael Moore. He's the director of the new documentary, Roger and Me. We did call Richard Jameson, the editor of Film Comment magazine, and he said they do stand behind the information in Harlan Jacobson's article about Michael Moore. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.